And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Paul Davies, world-renowned physicist. He has researched the areas of cosmology, gravitation, quantum field theory. Paul is interested in the nature of time, high-energy particle physics, the foundations of quantum mechanics. He was last on Coast to Coast 6 years ago, and here he is back for a couple hours on Coast to Coast. Paul, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Pleased to be back on the show.
Oh, likewise. So great work, by the way, the eerie silence. You know, Stephen Hawking a few weeks ago caused quite a stir and sensation when he basically said there is extraterrestrial life out there, but we better not contact them. We better not let them know we're here. You never know what could happen. What do you think of that?
Well, I think they were very foolish remarks. The first thing is that nobody knows whether there is any life beyond Earth, let alone intelligent life. We have no way of computing the odds. So he was making the statement that he thought the universe is so vast, there must be life out there somewhere. A lot of people say that, but it's simply a fallacious argument because we have no theory of life's origin. If we knew what the mechanism was that turned non-life into life, we could have a go at working out the odds. But we don't know how it happened, and so it could quite likely have been an accident that was so improbable it would have happened only once in the observable universe, or the other extreme, it could be something that is pretty much likely given Earth-like conditions, and we have no idea which is the case. And so that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that the claim that the aliens might want to come here and use the resources of our planet, and therefore we better avoid contact. Well, if they're after our planet, they could have taken it at any time in the last 4.5 billion years. What's keeping them? So, you know, I just don't think those sorts of arguments stack up, frankly.
There seems to be at this point, Paul, an incredible popularity searching for aliens. History Channel continues to do documentaries. Programs such as ours are very popular when we do stories of ETs and UFO possibilities. Even people like Stephen Hawking and yourself included with this incredible work, The Eerie Silence. What is causing the popularity today?
I'm really very mystified by it because I was interested in this stuff 50 years ago when the search for extraterrestrial intelligence began. I wrote the book because it's the 50th anniversary of the first SETI exercise. And in those days, it was considered pretty ridiculous. One might as well have expressed a belief in fairies. The prevailing view among scientists was that life is a freak event unique to Earth, that there is no life beyond Earth and certainly no intelligent life. It's a complete waste of time to think about it and to look for it. And now the pendulum has swung the other way. And as you correctly point out, there seems to be a surge of interest in the idea of extraterrestrial intelligent life. It's now okay to talk about ET. And I've thought long and hard about this, and the scientific facts haven't changed. The dominating fact is how did life get started in the first place? We're no further forward now than we were 50 years ago, just that the sentiment has changed. So this is purely factual, I think. I don't think there's any scientific basis. It's not that we can now say, because of what we discovered in the last few years, we can now be pretty sure that there is life out there, whereas in the past we couldn't. Frankly, we don't know a great deal more about the key factors. So it's just fashion, I think.
Paul, if it were proven ever that we were the only ones in this vast universe, all these billions of stars and planetary systems that could be out there, would it surprise you if we were all alone?
It wouldn't surprise me at all, because life is such an incredible thing that even the most simplest living thing that we know is already so stupendously complex that if it arose from a series of chemical accidents, self-assembly of the building blocks, then the odds against it may be enormous, and it will have happened only once. Even in a universe as vast as the one we observe, we can easily do the numbers. There are about 1 followed by 21, 22 zeros, potential Earth-like planets within the volume of the universe that we can access. And that's a very big number, but it's a tiny number compared to the odds of shuffling molecular building blocks into the right sort of shape and arrangement. But we don't know, of course, that that's the way that life did begin. It may be it was a result of some self-organizing chemistry, which is really quite likely, but it's only guesswork because we have no idea what the processes were. There are lots of possibilities. It's not that, we can't imagine how it could happen. We can imagine all sorts of ways in which it could happen. But seeing as we don't know which way, it's impossible to put the numbers in. So it's very likely that it could be an incredibly improbable accident, in which case we would be alone in the universe. And that is a sobering thought. I hope it's not right. I really would like to believe that we live in a universe teeming with life. But I'm a scientist, and we have to deal with the facts, not with sentiment.
SETI, you mentioned it, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They are searching for life, listening for signals, radio transmissions. Do you think that's the right way to go?
Well, it's the only way that's been tried systematically so far, and I'm a well-wisher. I give them a pat on the back. It's 50 years with nothing to show for it but an eerie silence, just the hiss and crackle of static from outer space. The SETI astronomers, and it's a small band of them, are very dedicated, and they say, well, give us a chance. It's a needle in a haystack search. You know, another 50 years might do it. But meanwhile, I feel that we should greatly extend the search for ET beyond using radio telescopes. We should be looking for all sorts of possible ways, any signature of technology that might show up would do. It would answer the question, are we alone in the universe, which is the key thing we're after. We don't have to receive a message or anything of that sort. We merely have to see some sort of sign, some technological footprint that shows that there's something going on out there in the galaxy that has no natural explanation. And that would be enough. It would be a truly momentous discovery to just say that.
And, Paul, you do recommend in that eerie silence to go out there to expand the search, to do whatever we have to do to find life, don't you?
Yes, and I really must pull you up on this idea of finding life. We're talking about intelligence. We're not talking about finding life. The subject of astrobiology is a major international subject. It's taught in universities now. And the search for life beyond Earth is proceeding on many fronts. Our greatest hope is perhaps finding microbes on Mars. We have to distinguish that from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, mm-hmm. Which is part, in a way, it's a part of the search for life, but it's really a much smaller, much more speculative enterprise. The vast majority of scientists who are searching for life beyond Earth, the astrobiologists, are much more concerned with things like sending spacecraft to Europa in case there's some sort of microbial life beneath the ice or something of that sort. So these are really two ends of a very long spectrum. Searching for extraterrestrial intelligence is something that has been done almost entirely by looking for what are called narrow-band radio signals, using radio telescopes to sweep the skies in the hope that there's some sort of message from ET coming our way. So far, nothing, of course, has been heard. And then the question is, can we extend this search beyond that rather limited strategy and find other ways for looking for ET? That's what interests me.
As a scientist, would you get excited about organisms that were discovered, let's say, on Saturn or Jupiter or Europa, somewhere out there, as opposed to the intelligent life that we know it today?
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. And it's really worth stressing that the vast majority of astrobiologists, that's what they're looking for. They're not really looking for intelligent life. I think there are many of them that think it's entirely likely that there's life on many other planets, but not intelligent life. My feeling is that the hard step is really going from non-life to life in the first place. But of course, it would be very exciting to find life elsewhere, but with one qualification, and it's a really important one, that what we're really interested in here is, do we live in a universe that is bio-friendly, that is teeming with life because life forms rapidly and automatically in the conditions that we have in this universe? Or is it a freakish event, an accident of chemistry, which has occurred just once? And we'll get the answer to that question if we can find a second sample of life. what we need is what Chris McKay at NASA Ames calls life 2.0. If we find life 2.0, even if it's just microbial life, then it makes the point that life can happen more than once. So we want a second sample of life, a second tree of life, a second origin of life. Then we know it happens easily, and it will therefore happen often. That's the key thing. We find life, for example, on Mars, you might think, well, that would make the point. That would be life 2.0. But I'm afraid it ain't so, because Mars and Earth exchange rocks, which are blasted off the planets by comets and asteroid impacts.
Let's talk more about that, Paul, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight, Paul Davies, The Eerie Silence. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest for 2 hours, Paul Davies, his latest work, The Eerie Silence. Paul, I've got to ask you about this. I don't know if you know about this or not, but Hillary Clinton, when she was talking to the late Lawrence Rockefeller, apparently had a copy of your book, Are We Alone?, and was trying to talk to him about extraterrestrial life. Lawrence Rockefeller, very interested in it, funded some research and surveys. But it looks like Hillary was meeting with him on his farm, holding your book. Did you know about that at all?
Yes, I did. I've seen the photograph, and I've had contact with Lawrence Rockefeller some years ago.
What do you think those two were trying to talk about?
Well, they may have been talking about something completely different, and it could be that that Mrs. Clinton was simply carrying the book to read on the train on the way home or something.
You never know.
I can't get to you. You'd have to ask her.
You never know. We left off before the break talking about the kind of life we would expect to find and what would excite a scientist, what would excite Paul Davies. And let's elaborate a little bit more on that. If we found life out there beyond, our planet, into the other planets, and it was, organisms to be sure, that you believe is still as exciting as almost finding a little bird or a rabbit or something, I would guess.
The key thing is life, and mostly almost all life on Earth is microbial, and so we need only think about finding microbes. But one microbe on Mars would suffice to make the point if we could be sure that it started from scratch independently of life on Earth. And the point I want to make is that we know Mars and Earth trade rocks, and they have been throughout their history, and microbes can hitch a ride on rocks and travel from Mars to Earth or in the other direction. So it seems that if you get life on one of those planets, you get it on both in pretty short order. So we do find life on Mars. That won't necessarily answer the question, has life happened more than once? And that's the key question we want to answer. So it would certainly be exciting to find life on Mars, but unless we could be sure it was independent of life on Earth, then we still wouldn't know. Maybe life is just a freak accident. It's just happened once, and it's splashed around a bit.
In reading The Eerie Silence, what would you like people to come away with?
Well, I think two things. One is that this search is thoroughly scientific. It's carried out by professional astronomers with the highest standards of scientific integrity. It's not a bunch of gung-ho amateurs who are credulous and dreamers. These are professional astronomers. And the second thing is that there are many other ways we could go looking for ET, and I've given many examples of them in the book. I've talked about looking for messages in the genomes of terrestrial organisms. I've talked about the possibility of looking for traces of extraterrestrial visitation on Earth 100 million years ago. There's no particular reason they would have come recently. And we could go look for those things. But in particular, what I set great store in is the search for the shadow biosphere, looking for the second sample of life that is so crucial to this enterprise. If we know life has happened more than once, then we can be pretty sure the universe is teeming with it, and that's an enormous boost for the whole SETI enterprise. But in the absence of having a second sample of life, we simply cannot be sure that we may well be alone in the universe. So looking for the shadow biosphere, which is the term that we now use to mean the possibility that life has happened more than once here on Earth, and that intermingled among all the microbes that we know and love might be some microbes representing a different type of life. So that is life, but not as we know it, right here on Earth, right under our noses, intermingled with the life that we see. And I think there is a good opportunity that if it's there, we'll find it within a few years. I'm pleased to say this research is being funded, and many of my colleagues are hot on the trail for looking for this shadow biosphere, this life 2.0, right here on Earth.
If you were speaking before a group of those who believe that they've seen UFOs, believe that they've been abducted by extraterrestrials, believe that we have been visited in the past and continue to be present, what would you tell that group, Paul, speaking before them? How would you start?
Well, I start by saying that that has nothing to do with SETI. You know, SETI is a scientific project. It is searching for radio signals coming from very far distant extraterrestrial civilizations, if they're out there. The stories of, little green men and flying saucers and so on belong in the same realm as ghost stories and fairy stories. This is not a scientific thing, they're stories. Many of my colleagues just sort of shrug it aside and say, well, it's complete nonsense. What I've tried to do in the book is not be dismissive, but to talk about my own involvement in trying to solve some UFO cases. And I knew Alan Hynek. He was the chief scientific advisor to the U.S. Air Force Project Blue Book, which for 20 years assessed thousands and thousands of reports. I visited Alan Hynek in his home just outside Chicago. We looked through reports together. He had a whole room full of, in those days, paper files. And over the years, I've had success in explaining a number of reports. And the most dramatic cases are, of course, the alien abductions. And I think most of those cases are explained in terms of sleep disorders, things like lucid dreaming and sleep paralysis. I've suffered from these myself. I know full well that they give the sort of impressions that people report when they talk about alien abductions, and I think that explains a very large fraction of them. The lights in the sky, there are many, many different types of explanations for those things. But whatever it is, I think it's got nothing to do with extraterrestrial life or extraterrestrial intelligence. It really says more about human beings than it does about extraterrestrials.
Are you, as a scientist, perplexed by just what is life? Why are we here? What's it all about?
Well, I'm certainly perplexed by the nature of life and its origin, and I think all scientists are. We have a very good explanation for how life evolves. It was given to us by Darwin 150 years ago by variation and natural selection. So we understand the mechanism of evolution. What we don't understand is how life came into existence in the first place. The difficulty there is it happened a long time ago. We may never have a blow-by-blow account of exactly what happened. But, of course, to answer this question, are we alone in the universe? We don't have to have a detailed account. We just need to know, was it a very likely event or a very unlikely event? And that's the thing that I keep coming back to. We have to search for this life 2.0 or the shadow biosphere or something like that. And that would demonstrate that it is a likely event. At the moment, it could. We can't be sure it wasn't just a freak accident. So I'm baffled by life, by its enormous complexity, by its extraordinary capacity to organize, and I think anyone who studies life can't fail but to be struck by how peculiar it is in relation to other physical systems that we study. And then there's the broader question about why do we live in a universe that's fit for life at all? That is, why is life permitted to arise anywhere? And that's a deeper question about the nature of the laws of physics and how the universe came into existence. I've written books about that too, but sure. This more recent book is specifically about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
And you believe we should continue to search?
Oh, very definitely. In fact, what I'm doing in this book, it's a wake-up call for the scientific community to expand the search, to go beyond looking for narrow-band radio signals and look for all sorts of other things like beacons and messages in genomes and geological evidence for possible extraterrestrial probes that might have been sent here in the past. There's all sorts of ways that, we could look beyond just for radio signals. Once we get away from the idea that, we've got to look for signals, we really, if we just want to answer the question, are we alone? If we want to look for some footprint of alien technology, whether in our own astronomical neighborhood or way, way across the galaxy, then there's many more things we can look for other than radio messages. So I think we need to expand the search. We need to draw up a list from all of the scientific disciplines of the sort of things that would show up if there was some alien technology at work. Those clues may be very subtle. I like to draw the analogy with the scene of a crime. There's a dead body, and you can't be sure, did this person die of natural causes, or was there some skullduggery going on? That was there some agency behind it? And as every forensic scientist knows, the clues may be very subtle, and you may need to use a whole range of scientific techniques to tease them out. And we're faced with that situation. We look around the universe, and superficially, it looks like there's no life, no intelligence. But we maybe should look a little bit more carefully, and buried in all that data, we might just see the subtle telltale signs of alien technology at work.
Would it shock you, Paul, if archaeologists discovered some kind of relic of like a Mars rover, but it was here on this planet that might have been sent here then from a extraterrestrial source?
Well,
100 million years ago, and they found it here?
Yeah, the trouble is, you see, a Mars rover wouldn't last 100 million years on Earth. That if you think about coming back in the future and what would survive of human technology, there's almost nothing that we see around us today that would survive
right.
100 million years, and all the plastic cups and you know, bits of wire and so on would be long gone.
Gone. It'd be dust. Everything would be dust.
Because the surface of our Earth is restless. The tectonic activity, the glaciation, the impact from asteroids, the erosion, it all gets swept away and buried. Because even in the very recent past, just within the last few thousand years, the historical relics are underground. You've got to dig them out. After 100 million years, there's very little that could remain. But there are some things. For example, nuclear waste. We could find nuclear waste that was dumped 100 million years ago, and we could date it. We could know exactly when it was left behind. So if there was some alien expedition passed through this way and left a clue with nuclear waste, we could find that in principle. If there were any mining activity that created large, irregular-shaped holes in the ground, even though they might be buried and be deep beneath rock strata, we could pick them up in geological surveys. And then, of course, if there were an alien visitation 100 million years ago and they engaged in some sort of biotechnology, engineered organisms, for example, for mineral processing or agriculture or who knows what, then the remnants of that tinkering might still be all around us today if we knew what to look for. So I think there are things that would last, but they would be rather subtle. They're not going to be in your face.
Paul, what about the multiverse theory, the fact that there are other universes out there that could be life in those universes? Is that possible?
It's by definition it's possible. If you have enough universes, then it's the numbers game. You're going to inevitably have life somewhere. So you don't need multiple universes for that. You just need one universe that's big enough. So however small the odds are for life forming in an infinite universe, it's bound to happen infinitely often. So it's just the old dictum that in an infinite universe, anything that can happen will happen, and it will happen infinitely often. And so it doesn't really help very much because the volume of the universe that we can see is limited to about 13.7 billion light years in each direction. And that's because that's the distance that light has traveled since the Big Bang. And because nothing can go faster than light, there's no way that anything beyond that distance can influence us. We might as well forget about it, but there may be life an immense distance beyond that horizon in space. But there's no way that we could ever be in contact with it or know about it, and so it becomes a rather idle speculation.
Would you, back to SETI, would you keep funding them? Would you expand their funding? What would you do with SETI?
It's very important to realize that SETI is not publicly funded. It's private donations only.
Right.
What they get is just about adequate for the more ambitious plans, the jewel in the crown of the SETI program is the Allen Telescope Array. It's named after the principal benefactor, Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, being built in Northern California. And it will be a system of 350 dishes hooked together electronically so that it represents a single instrument of very large power. So that will enormously increase the sensitivity of the search. To date, only 42 of them have been completed. And so, yes, of course, more money is always welcome. But my feeling about the whole SETI program is that what they've been doing so far is fine, and may they go on doing it and doing it better. But we do need the search in other ways at the same time. And most of the things I suggest in the book don't actually cost any money. For example, looking at genomic data, genomes are being sequenced anyway. It costs nothing to run those through a computer algorithm to see if there's some sort of message in a bottle left there, where the bottle is living cells and the message is etched into DNA. We know the viruses are uploading their messages into living cells all the time. About 20% of human DNA is just viral detritus that has been picked up along the evolutionary way. And so if viruses can do it, ET can do it. And so one scenario, which I discussed briefly earlier, is that, you know, maybe an alien probe or an expedition came here and deliberately uploaded information into the DNA, and maybe they sent viruses that injected it into the DNA. It's obviously a wacky idea. It's a long shot, but maybe it's no more crazy than the aliens putting messages in radio waves. So we could go look for that. We could just run that through a computer algorithm to try and pick out those messages. It's worth doing, not because I seriously think that there are messages in genomes, but just because it costs nothing to look.
Right. Assuming we survive 1,000 years from now, can you even imagine what we will be like, technologically speaking, in the year 3,000, for example? What do you think this planet will look like? What do you think we'll be able to do?
Well, of course, it's always hard to predict the future, because usually it's the unexpected which brings about the dramatic changes. So when I think back through my own career, I was always interested in these futurology books when I was a young lad, and they showed things like huge skyscrapers with traffic ways and monorails connecting them high up above the ground and things like that. What was completely overlooked was the information revolution. That's the thing that has really transformed our society. And so who knows what the future holds. But one thing I think is pretty clear, and that is that in this search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the key is the intelligence. We tend to think, well, therefore we search for life, and life is the first step on the road to intelligence. But it's pretty clear to me that biological intelligence is a rather brief phase in the evolution of intelligence in the universe, that we're very soon going to hand over pretty much all of the intellectual heavy lifting to design artificial systems. Computers and robots are the first glimmering of that. The internet is the next glimmering. I often say that Google is smarter than any person on the planet. And if we imagine fast-forwarding 1,000 years, as you suggest, it's very hard to imagine that the most important knowledge systems and information processing systems are really going to be flesh and blood. I think they're almost certainly going to be designed and distributed systems. The great thing about, say, something like the internet is it can just be made richer, bigger, immortal. It can go on forever. It can design its own next generation and the generation after that. It can go on getting bigger and more powerful. We can imagine the entire surface of a planet or a moon being covered like a gigantic throbbing artificial megabrain. And all this could be achieved in a pretty short period of time. So I think it's pretty clear that if we do make contact with an advanced intelligence, one that maybe has a 100-million-year pedigree, that we're going to be talking about something very strange and very non-biological.
Absolutely. Paul, stay with us. We're going to take phone calls with you next hour. It'll be our final hour with Paul Davies, floating format tonight, right here on Coast to Coast AM. His work, The Eerie Silence, available at major bookstores. It's on Amazon.com. And we'll take your phone calls with Paul Davies when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Paul Davies with us. We'll take your phone calls this hour. Paul, I want to thank you for staying with us. By the way, do you travel much, Paul?
I travel almost continuously. So I'm off to London tomorrow. Just a week ago, I was touring the West Coast, and the week before that, touring the East Coast of the United States. And I've already made two trips to Britain this year before this one, and it goes on like that right through the year.
How did Paul Davies get interested in science?
Well, I tell people I was born a physicist. from the earliest age I can remember, when I grew up in North London, I was fascinated by scientific things. I can remember looking up at the sky as a 7 or 8 year old and just seeing this wonderland of stars and strange objects and thinking, you know, what was it all about? And I was always interested as well, looking the other way, into inner space, to atoms and things you couldn't see, and mysterious forces and force fields and things like that. So right from the start, from the very earliest age, I was hooked on science, and it's been a passion that's been with me my whole life. I was resolved to become a scientist in my early teens, and I just stuck to it, and I'm very fortunate that I've been able to live out my dream.
Excellent. Let's go to some phone calls here, Paul. This hour's going to go by very quickly. West of the Rockies in Modesto, California. Aaron, you're on with Paul Davies. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hello, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Mr. Davies, let's say we do get a sample of life from Mars. Okay?
Right.
And we have all this technology to sequence DNA.
Right.
Can we take that sample and test it to find out if we were related, or can... We'd be on such evolutionary different paths that the DNA might not be similar at all.
Right. So earlier I was saying that Mars and Earth trade rocks, and they've been doing this throughout their history, and microbes can hitch a ride in these rocks. And so if you get life on one of these two planets, you get it on both. And so there's every chance, if we have a Mars sample return mission, which is one of the objectives of the astrobiology program, the spacecraft will go there and bring back rocks for us to study. We might just find evidence of microbial life in those rocks, and it may very well turn out to be the same life as ours. That is DNA-based life. We could sequence the DNA and position it on the known tree of life. It would simply be an organism like any others related to us with a common origin, either on Mars or Earth, but stretching back a long way. What we'd be much more excited by is if we brought back a microorganism from Mars that was completely unrelated to life on Earth, with a different organization, a different biochemistry, something that was so different that we could say it must have had a separate origin. That's what we really want. We want life 2.0.
Well, what do you think of the possibilities of the United States, the European Union, getting together to send astronauts into space, to back to the moon, off to Mars, rather than what's going on right now?
I think a lot of people have lost interest in the space program, that the International Space Station just goes round and round, doesn't really go anywhere, and that the bold opening up of the high frontier, which was so much part of my youth, all that zeal has gone away. And I'm afraid that probably... the United States isn't going to get it back. I look to China and maybe India in another 50 years as being the trailblazers. My feeling is that we could go to Mars now with current technology, with the political will, but it needs to be a one-way mission only. And I've pushed very strongly over many years that the idea that we have to have an expedition and bring the astronauts back just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's far, far cheaper to go one way only, and to set up a permanent base on Mars that will become the nucleus of what would eventually be a Mars colony. It would be ultimately self-sustaining over a few centuries.
So you're saying, whoever
astronauts now.
Whoever goes, they're not coming back?
That's right. So this is not a suicide mission, but of course you send on equipment ahead so that they can build a habitat and grow some food for themselves, and they can be resupplied every couple of years, and eventually other colonists would come to join them. And of course, their life expectancy would be reduced, but so would it if they came back. So my feeling is that this would cut the cost enormously, and the sort of people you would send would be scientists who could do fantastic work on the Martian surface. They could make new discoveries, publish their results. They would go down in history, the trailblazers of a colony on a new planet. There'd be plenty of people who would volunteer for that. It cuts out all of the complication of having to take the fuel for the return journey and all those other things that push up the cost. But the political will isn't there. It's very sad because it seems to me so obvious that this is the way forward for Mars exploration.
That would be an incredible mission. The volunteers for something like that, no doubt, huh, Paul?
Plenty of volunteers left Europe and came to the United States knowing they wouldn't be going back. Maybe even been people who've gone off to Antarctica pretty much in the knowledge that there's been a 50-50 chance they would survive. But they did it. 100 years ago, there was that sort of expeditionary exploration zeal. We seem to have lost it, at least in the West.
Let's go to Danville, Illinois. Richard's there, east of the Rockies. Hey, good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie. I'm Professor Davies. Excuse me. In Star Trek, they have something called a non-interference directive. And I was wondering how this might fare also with some speculations for over 30 years by various scientists that it wouldn't be a good idea contacting any advanced civilizations. Also, they could be out there just hiding and watching us over, like, for an example, on Earth, certain organisms like the trapdoor spider and the tunnel spider, which supposedly is only from northern provinces of Australia. But believe me, brother, they got them here.
Yeah, they do.
And
I'm familiar with the funnel web spider. I still have a house in Australia, and we have funnel web spiders around the house from time to time. But this idea that there is some sort of sinister agenda that the aliens mean us harm, I've never been able to take that seriously. What possible interest could we be to them? I can understand that our planet may be of interest to an extraterrestrial civilization that maybe is depleted in resources and wants to, like I was just talking about, we could colonize Mars. Maybe they will want to colonize Earth. Well, that's fine. Our presence on Earth is going to make no difference one way or the other. They could have come to Earth any time in the past 4.5 billion years. If they did come, they didn't stay. And so the idea that somehow we're going to be responsible for bringing this down upon us, I've never understood this. That if we imagine a hypothetical civilization, say, 1,000 light years away, which is, if you ask SETI optimists, how near is the nearest civilization likely to be? That's the typical sort of distance. Well, they could have instruments powerful enough to see that planet Earth has all what it takes as a place to live. So if they wanted Earth for the planet, they could have come at any time in the past. They don't need us to tell them about it. They don't need us to be in contact with them to invite them here. They could just come anyway. The fact that they haven't suggests to me that either they're not there at all, or that if they are there, they're not interested in taking over our planet.
Paul, if we're being visited, why is it shrouded in secrecy? Why don't they make themselves known?
Right. I don't take seriously the idea that we are being visited. As I said earlier, I think it's not impossible that some sort of probe or expedition could have passed through the solar system sometime during its history. But that's an awfully long history. It's 4.5 billion years. At any time in that stage, some sort of alien activity could have happened here. But we then have to think on a timescale of billions of years, not thousands of years, billions. And so over those immense periods of time, it's very hard to know, as I said earlier, what would survive, what remnant, what trace there would be of some alien visitation. I can't take seriously the idea that the aliens are coming here now. Why should that would just be too much of a coincidence? They should happen to show up just as we started getting interested in them from watching Hollywood movies or something. You know, just the world doesn't work that way. If the aliens were going to come, they've had a long time in which they could have done that. And for them to just show up at this particular time, it's just too much of a coincidence. I couldn't take it seriously.
Charles is in Mojave, California, and you're on with Paul Davies. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, You just about touched on my question. It seems to me one of the things to focus on and look at, perhaps with a system like microlaunchers to examine thousands of near-Earth asteroids, to look for the chance that perhaps somebody, even a billion years ago, had sent in a robotic spacecraft, which is how we would investigate a solar system. It would do its thing, send its messages, and then be here still orbiting among the near-Earth asteroids. And it seems reasonable that it might be directed to come in to the inner part of the solar system where the interesting planets are, you know, the rocky terrestrial planets. And the solar system 4 billion years ago was probably highly recognizable, I mean, probably very much resembled the way it is now. So it might be worthwhile to develop a program to try to photograph by actual flybys thousands of near-Earth asteroids in hopes that one of them might be an old, worn-out, spent spacecraft, which would still be physically intact, of course not functional, but recognizable as an artifact.
Right. I think I agree very much with your suggestion.
Yeah, and micro-launchers might be a way to do it. It's a way to send thousands of 100-gram photographic spacecraft out.
What I have done in the eerie silence is consider precisely this possibility. There could be a probe that has been in our solar system for a very long period of time. It might be dormant. It might still be functional. It might be waiting for us to activate it in some way, or it may just be passively listening, monitoring our radio broadcasts or monitoring the Internet, and one day we'll announce its appearance. The favorite place to put such a thing is the so-called Earth-Sun Lagrange point. So these are points in space where you can keep pace with Earth as it orbits the Sun without using any fuel. But the asteroid belt, so if you wanted to hide something, of course, there's thousands and thousands of objects there. You could easily hide a fairly large craft in the asteroid belt without us being aware of it. To search the entire asteroid belt is an immense undertaking because there really are a lot of objects there. Some of them can be photographed quite well from Earth or from near space. To send probes there, I think, would be a pretty massive undertaking. But you're entirely right. So there could easily be some alien probe there, and it could have been there for a long period of time. One other scenario is that if there are alien civilizations that are hungry for resources, one of the things they might do is move in on a newly forming planetary system and scavenge the raw materials as it's forming. And so we could look at freshly forming planetary systems, such as in the Orion Nebula, and look very carefully for large-scale astroengineering projects or for systems that are depleted, for example, in certain substances, anomalously depleted in certain substances, and wonder if, in fact, you know, ET has sequestered them all. So these are all the sorts of things I suggest in the book.
There is a theory by a Zachariah Sitchin, Paul, that from his interpretation of Sumerian texts, that we were visited 400,000 years ago for that purpose, to mine for resources and to bring them back to their planet. So the similarities are pretty uncanny.
Well, you see, apart from this timescale, 400,000 years sounds like a long time in human
terms.
But you know, in astronomical terms, it's really very recent, and I would be astonished if such a visitation happened in such a recent past. And, of course, there's no way that the Sumerians could possibly have known such a thing, so I don't take reports like that terribly seriously.
It sounds like, Paul, you would not be surprised one way or another, that being we're the only ones in the universe or that the universe is teeming with life.
Right.
I think you could accept either possibility, right?
And I think this is the correct attitude for a scientist to take. Scientists should always be skeptical, and they should always be open-minded. These are not conflicting, but you have to take the view when reflecting on these difficult, these imponderable subjects. You have to take the point of view, well, if we don't have any evidence, then the correct position to take is skepticism. We must never close our minds to the fact that that one day the evidence may be forthcoming. So my attitude is we don't know one way or the other because we don't know how life began. We don't know if it was a fluke event or if it's a highly expected event, fashioned in my lifetime has gone from it's a fluke event to now that it's everywhere. But we don't know because we don't know how life began. If we could only crack that problem, we'd move this subject way, way ahead. And that's why I invest so much importance in looking for life 2.0. If we can just find a second sample of life on Earth, then we know that the universe is going to be teeming with it. And then the way lies open for looking for all life elsewhere, and in particular intelligent life. But until that time, it would not surprise me if we are, in fact, alone in the universe. This is the only planet with life. It's just a bizarre freak event in one little corner of the cosmos. That would be very sad, in my view. Some people think it would give us greater significance. But I think a truly bio-friendly universe would, for me, be much more congenial. But that's just a sort of philosophical position, not a scientific one.
All right, let's go to Los Angeles. We go. Go ahead, Douglas. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yes, Mr. Davies, I want to ask you a question. I've been involved in the Coast Bar, the Committee on Space Research. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am, yes.
All right, and Jill Tarter, she's done some things there. But what is what I'm wondering is why the SETI does not check out the serendipitous discoveries and developments of instruments. Back in like 2002, it was submitted through the Coast Bar and to trying to get to Jill Tarter in California, the guy that developed the instrument and has already made the contact. He talked to a Kent Coolers. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Kent Coolers. He's a blind guy at the SETI Institute.
Oh, right, right. Yes, I know who you mean, yes.
He was taking the calls for Jill Tarter, but it's already been done. The instrument has been developed, but the SETI does not come out to even see. They've been invited to do the...
I'm a little baffled as to what instrument you're talking about.
It's, it's called the Davoscope Air Trans 3. It's an acoustical audio optical image receiver, transmitter, transducer, transponder. It was developed by a young guy, 20-year-old guy in Texas at the J.C. Trimble Tech. He was in radio school, but it was an accidental development with like a one-meter emission grid. It was kind of a joke. He just said, this looks like an emission grid. Let's see what happens.
But you said acoustical.
Yeah, acoustical audio.
Well, but acoustics is no good beyond the Earth, I'm afraid, because it's space out there. And
no, they're transmitting. Right. With the extraterrestrials are transmitting on a flat beam that is actually carrying acoustical along with, it's a pulsed flat beam, but it's also traversing a sound actually is going along this flat beam of pulsed beam of light.
But I must stop you. Unfortunately, sound doesn't travel through space, so it's not a lot of help, I'm afraid.
It won't get here, or vice versa.
Right.
Will it, Paul?
Right.
Paul, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment with the final segment of phone calls for you right here on Coast to Coast. Paul Davies' work, the latest one, The Eerie Silence. We'll be back. Paul, when you talk about the possibility of life out there, life here as well, do you sometimes bring in the spirituality at all? And most scientists do not. I was wondering if you.
I've reserved a section of my book for the impact on religion of the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence, and I might say also the discovery of any form of extraterrestrial life. We were talking earlier about the search for life 2.0, whether we live in a universe which is intrinsically bio-friendly, so life pops up all over the place wherever there are Earth-like conditions, or the opposite extreme, which is it's a freakish event that's happened only once. And I feel that these are, in a sense, spiritual issues. Some people feel that to have life unique to Earth invests it with a certain significance it would otherwise lack. I feel exactly the opposite, that a universe which brings forth life and who knows, mind as well, as an integral part of the outworkings of deeply bio-friendly laws, to me is the more spiritual point of view. So these are weighty issues, and inevitably deep questions like are we alone in the universe touch upon those aspects of life which we could most broadly call spiritual. And I think everybody, whether they're conventionally religious or not, has that dimension to themselves. Everyone wonders, looks up at the universe and sees how majestic it is and wonders, what does it all mean and where do I fit in? And SETI, in a way, is part of catering to that that deep spiritual yearning, but to know who we are and where we fit into the great scheme of things.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go. First-time caller, truck driving in Virginia. Katura is with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Good, Kat. Go ahead.
I just want to say thanks, first off. My question is, you know, you hear all this about aliens and everything getting mixed in with religion and everything, and I do believe that all mixed in somehow or another. Why don't they allow us to look under the foot or the base or whatever of the Sphinx? Because I've heard repeatedly that there is so much information, literature. I don't know if it's what it is. I don't know if it's just stone tablets, but there's all kinds of things up under the feet of the Sphinx. I mean, what's the big deal with they've let us dig everywhere else? Why can't we dig under there and find out what Edgar Cayce said about the Atlanteans and everything else? That's my question, because they also said that there is information on alien life form along with other information that actually goes into religion.
All right. I'm going to answer this for you, Keturah, and Paul, I'll let you chime in if you want. The American prophet, the late Edgar Cayce, once said that there were three areas on this planet that contained Hall of Records, one being in Bimini, the other somewhere around Central America, and then the third being at the base of the Sphinx. It has been found that there is a cavern somewhere at the base of the Sphinx by the paw. Zahi Hawass has said on this program there's nothing there. I'm not so sure. I think maybe the Egyptians know there is some kind of chamber there. Whether they've already dug into it or not, I don't know, Paul. But that is part of some of the things that you're saying, and that is archaeological digs that could show up some kind of evidence of some kind of past that would be very important to us.
Well, I don't think so, no. I think I've been at pains to point out that if there had been any alien visitation on Earth, it's likely to have been, you know, typically 100 million years ago, the idea that there have been aliens on Earth within historical times, so that there would be records that could be dug out of an archaeological dig, seems to me just completely ridiculous, because it would be far too much of a coincidence that the aliens should show up just as humans were occupying the planet. Human beings, human society on this planet is only a few tens of thousands of years old. The planet is 4.5 billion years old. We're not talking millions, we're talking billions, immense periods of time. Why would it be the case that in this universe, which is 13.7 billion years old, there were stars and planets around long before the solar system even existed, why would it be the case that aliens should show up on our doorstep just as human beings were here? It would just be too much of a coincidence. So if we're going to find evidence for alien visitation, it will be an immense period of time, long before there were any humans. We're not going to get any help from archaeological digs, I'm afraid. It will be from some other type of survey altogether.
Let me ask you this about the formation of the solar system and the universe in general. If the universe is around 13.5-14 billion years old,
right,
and our solar system is 4.5 billion years old,
correct.
What happened in that gap of you know, 8.5 billion years? Why did it take 8.5 billion years for our solar system to get developed?
Right. Well, you must understand that star systems, planetary systems, are forming all the time. You can see them forming now. So, for example, the constellation of Orion, I think, is familiar to all Americans. There's the belt of Orion, and beneath that, the so-called sword of Orion. You look through binoculars, you'll see that the middle star of that sword is, in fact, not a star at all. It's a great mass of gas, and embedded in that gas are newly forming stars and planetary systems, hundreds and hundreds of them. So planets are forming all the time, stars and planets forming all the time, and they have been back through the history of the galaxy. And so it just happens that our particular solar system formed about 4.5 billion years ago, but there were plenty of others forming before that. And we can see these more ancient stars, and very soon we'll be able to see the planets that are going around them. And so it's a continuous process, and we just happen to be, you know, in the middle of this great drama. There will be stars still forming in another 3 or 4 billion years' time.
Why didn't we form all at the same time? I mean, if the Big Bang occurred, why wasn't everything just done at the same time? Was it because
When the Big Bang coughed out all the gases, They were smoothly distributed. And the only reason that we have any stars and galaxies is because gravity pulls these gases together and eventually causes them to get more and more clumpy. And that process is very slow. We can now model that on computers and simulate it very, very accurately, that formation of clumpiness and aggregation of material. But it's a slow process. Gravity is a very weak force. It takes a long while to pull things in. And so the first stars were superstars. They were giants that burned very quickly and then exploded. And the next generation of stars were smaller, and they contained some of the material from those first-generation stars. And so it's been going on. There's no real mystery about this. It is just the gravity is a weak force, and these are slow processes.
All right, let's go to Mike in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Mike, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Davies.
Hi.
Can you explain why there are thousands of sightings every year by credible witnesses, and yet SETI goes on? And also, can you give us any information on a consultation that you gave to Rockefeller?
Right. I think we've dealt with these things earlier in the show. The SETI's got nothing to do with UFO stories. SETI is searching for evidence for alien technology way out there across the galaxy somewhere. So far, it hasn't found any evidence for it, but they go on looking. The UFO stories are like ghost stories and fairy stories. They're stories. They're not scientific data. I explained earlier how I was involved in the early days with Alan Hynek, the chief scientific advisor to U.S. Air Force Project Blue Book. Mm-hmm. I explained a number of cases myself. I think the alien abduction stories are sleep disorders. The lights in the sky have all sorts of explanations ranging from meteorological effects to ball lightning, and who knows, maybe some mysterious physical effects that we haven't yet explained but will do soon. But I see none of this as evidence for extraterrestrial visitation. I keep saying it would just be incredible, far too much of a coincidence, that aliens would come here now just as we're getting interested in them, when they've had 4.5 billion years to come to our planet. It just doesn't add up to me.
Next up, we go to Lexington, Kentucky. Steve is east of the Rockies. Hey, Steve, go ahead.
Hey, Dr. Davis, it's an honor to speak with you. I just had three quick things, and I'll take my answers off the air. On your website, you had mentioned physics and cancer and working with the U.S. National Cancer Institute, and I was wondering if you would expand on that work a little bit and what their aims are and what that research is about.
Yes, I'd be very pleased to do that. The National Cancer Institute spends many billions of dollars of taxpayers' money annually on cancer research and the conventional research, which is these days primarily gene-based and chemical-based, is proceeding on a broad front. But when you look at the statistics over the 40 years or so since President Nixon famously declared a war on cancer, the mortality rate from cancer has hardly changed. Very, very depressing. And so in an extraordinarily bold move a year or so ago, the National Cancer Institute decided to spend some small fraction of its resources to get thinkers from outside of the field. And they are particularly impressed by the fact that physicists have a good track record of solving complex problems by thinking about them in creative and innovative new ways. And so they have set up a network of 12 centers of physical science and oncology, and I head up the one here at Arizona State University. And so we have physicists and physical chemists and mathematicians working together with oncologists and cancer biologists just to try to think cancer in totally new ways. It's very exciting, it's very challenging, and I really do hope it makes a difference. We need that big breakthrough, that penicillin moment that has transformed other ailments. We haven't seen that in cancer. That's what we're after.
Go ahead, Steve. Couple more questions.
Okay. You'd also mentioned the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences, and I was wondering what your work involved with them was. And I was also wondering if you could comment on the Large Hadron Collider and what that device might be able to tell us about how life may be able to develop and start from inorganic origins.
Right. Well, we've got a fair range of questions there. I was just last week lecturing at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences in Berkeley. I have no formal association with it. They invite me there from time to time to give talks about the overlap between science and theology. It's something that's interested me for many years. As far as the Large Hadron Collider is concerned, this is a particle accelerator, so this is not directly connected with the issue of the origin of life, much more connected with the issue of the origin of the universe. This machine, which is in Switzerland, can recreate the conditions that prevailed 1/1,000,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang, when the universe was intensely hot. And so by colliding protons together at enormous energies, we can glimpse the sort of processes that helped forge the structure of our universe right back at the very beginning. But this has only a very indirect bearing on the problem of the origin of life, which came much, much later.
Douglas is in Fresno, California. Hey, Douglas, go ahead.
Great show tonight, George.
Yeah.
As always. Dr. Davies, a great honor to have a moment of your time.
Thank you.
I have to admit I haven't read the latest book yet, but I'll run out and get it tomorrow. The last one I read, though, was How to Build a Time Machine.
Right.
In which you discuss the various components required in building a hypothetical machine of that sort. In particular, I was interested if you could maybe discuss that subject a bit, maybe elaborate upon one of the particular components involved, a negative energy source through the Casimir effect.
Right, yes.
Has there been any recent progress in that area in terms of, say, amplifying that effect? Would something like a negative energy laser be a possibility?
Right.
And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Douglas.
Right, right. I mean, this is the subject of my previous book, and the short answer is I don't think that there has been a great deal of progress since I wrote that book. But the notion that there can be negative energy is thoroughly established. These are weird quantum effects, and harnessing them is an enormous challenge. But we know that in principle it could be done.
Okay, very good. Shane in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Hi, Shane. Go ahead.
Hi. Good show tonight. Dr. Davies, I have a question for you. You said you were searching for life 2.0, and ever since I've been listening tonight, I've been stewing this question in my brain, and it's that, have you or anybody in your field taking into account that or looked into the fact that viruses may be life 2.0, considering how different they are than the rest of biological, and that they may be alien or they may have been a second start to life?
Now, it's very interesting, this whole subject of viruses. Now, the viruses that we're familiar with, the common cold and the AIDS virus and smallpox and things like that, they're definitely the same form of life. And the reason they're dangerous is precisely that. They infect cells, living cells, with the same sort of DNA and get into their works and basically create problems. Now, of course, what we can't rule out is that there are virus-like particles that prey on cells which are not life as we know it. In other words, this life 2.0 might be there, and it may well have viruses that are parasitic upon it. And we could go look for the viruses instead of looking for the cells themselves. The point about that is the viruses get everywhere. So if, for example, you take just a cubic centimeter of ocean water, it's crawling. Well, crawling is probably the wrong word, but it's replete with viruses. The ocean is pretty much virus soup. And so one of the things that's not been done, but I'm urging biologists to do it, is to look very carefully to see whether some component of that viral soup might be viral particles which are contain not DNA or RNA, but some other type of informational molecule altogether. And that would be a very strong pointer to the existence of life 2.0.
Paul, why do we have this desire, this quest to find out if we're alone in the universe? It's inside of us. It eats away at us. How come?
Well, it is. And earlier we were talking about the spiritual dimension of this entire exercise. And I think we're born, really, with this desire to know how we fit in. Ever since human beings have tried to understand their world and to look beyond just their daily lives and try to see the bigger picture, they've been intrigued by these sorts of questions. And I think that the notion of us sharing the universe with other sentient beings is a very, very powerful one, and it goes right back into ancient history. Because if you look at all early societies, they all had some sort of mythology around the notion of other sentient beings elsewhere, either living in the sky or under the ground or appearing to them in dreams or something. But this notion that the universe is populated by beings as opposed to just objects is something very, very deep-rooted, and it goes back into ancient history and presumably has a deep biological explanation in terms of our evolutionary path.
Let's go to Indianapolis, Indiana. Alan, we've got about a minute for you. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Davies?
Yes, hello.
I was wondering if you could tell me what the sensitivity is of the SETI radio telescope, the Allen Array. For example, I know if it were set up on the moon, it would be able to detect the electromagnetic leakage from the Earth quite easily.
Oh, yeah.
Well, how many light years away would it still be able to detect the Earth?
Right. You have to decide on the strength of the transmitter. But if you ask the question, could it pick up a TV station on a planet going around the nearest star, then the disappointing answer is no. Even with that sensitivity, it could not detect routine traffic. But if you had something like another Allen Array or an Arecibo telescope on a planet going around the nearest star beaming directly at us, then yes, we picked that up.
Paul, we're out of time. I want to thank you for spending two fascinating hours with us. Paul Davies, the eerie silence. You were last on 6 years ago. Let's not wait that long again, okay?
That time goes so quickly. It's 6 years already. But
we've got a time travel next time, don't we?
We're going to have to do that. But at least now I'm almost on the same time zone. I'm now living in the United States.
It's a big difference. Thank you, Paul. Paul Davies.